Exit number 11281, Reel 9.
Kelly, Reel 9.
The 15 underweights were American, I think. Guys, I think they were called. Guys. And, you know, maybe the three chonner. So I used a horse to carry the stores. And we had the various heavy stores that we had to carry, boxes of ammunition, things like that, draped over the side of the horse. And we marched through this village, this small town of, I think it was Douves. I think it was called Douves. D-O-U-R-V-E-S. I think that's the way you spelt it. And I was marching through, we were marching through there, and I was leading the horse. And as I say, it was a beautiful animal. And this RAC officer spotted us, and he asked me what I was doing with it. So he said, he won't be able to take it with you. He said, but I give it to him. And he offered us a wagon load of rations in his place. So I was encouraged by the rest of them to make the swap. And I knew that the horse was no good to me. I was only leading it away because I didn't know what would happen to it if I left it behind. And I knew I couldn't take it if we were going to carry on fighting. And we moved from there, and I think we just went into an open area on some sloping ground. And it was more of a tank park. There were lots and lots of tanks parked there. And we bivvied there for the night. And then I think from there onwards, we went to a place called Salonelles. I think that was our next stop. And we were sort of going into the line then to bolster the line up the bridge yard and to strengthen that. And we moved in, and they had all the commando brigade that I belonged to, which had number 4 commando, 4-1 commando, I think it was 4-5, possibly 4-7, I'm not sure, what it comprised of at that time, the brigade. But I know 4 commando were our immediate neighbours on one side, and then we had the airborne on the other. So it looked as though they were holding one of the weaker ends, or the flanks of the bridgehead, with troops like us who had no artillery, no tanks, no heavy weapons, and relying on us to hold the gap and to fill it in and make it look as though we outnumber the enemy, you know, and we're quite strong. So that's when the concept of dominating no man's land came in. And they said, you know, well, if you dominate no man's land, you'll know what the enemy are doing. They'll never know what we're doing. And if we keep them occupied and tormented, then we'll be doing our job successfully. And gradually, we were given a little bit of artillery support on odd occasions from tanks that had been knocked out, lost their tracks, damaged in some way, but the guns were still workable. So they used to use those on occasions. And if we picked out targets for them, you know, we could get them to put fire down on the Germans, you know, just to keep them occupied. And there were several schemes like that. In actual fact, there was things like promising us one day's leave for every live German we captured, or something of that nature. And we were encouraged to torment them as much as possible. And in doing this, and in our defensive locality, we had amassed a lot of German weapons. We had German mortars small German mortars. And I had a German, apart from my own Bren gun, I had a German MG-42. And the small wooden boxes, which were about a foot deep, about 12 inches square, I had one of those filled with German ammunition in one big long link. I'd linked them all up, and they're all from different places, you know, different areas. I picked them, you know, you picked them up lying about. And I hadn't a clue of what the colours meant. And a lot of the bullets had colours painted on the nose. Green, red, yellow, things like that. Now, I expected that some of them were tracer, because ours were identified in similar ways to show you that there was a tracer bullet or it's an armour-piercing bullet, things like that. So they painted black. Just the tip of the bullet, the point of the bullet was painted. So anyway, I'd packed all these things in and laid them all out so that I would have one long string of fire if ever I needed to use it. And because we were defensive, I thought it was ideal, you see. And I could use all their ammunition on them before I actually got round to using my Bren, my own gun. That was the theory, anyway. But it was relatively quiet. And it was only the patrol work that we were doing there that kept us busy. But patrol work is a mental sort of fighting thing, attitude. And it plays havoc, eventually, with men if they are continually there and they're not sleeping properly, and or they're not sleeping at all, and so on. And we used to do patrols that went out just as it went dark at night and came back just before it got light in the morning. And so they were out there all night and wide awake. And then there was another one which you went out before it became light, and you stayed out there all day while it was light. Now you can't, you can't drink or eat properly if your movement is the thing that's going to give you away. And the very fact that you get there while it's dark, make sure that nobody sees you getting there. And you've got to lie concealed all through the day. And, you know, the mental strain on you, because, you know, you've got to urinate and things like this. And to urinate, you merely could only turn sideways. You know, and you were lying alongside your stuff, you know. And things like that, all, you know, I suppose they have their effect of wearing you down. And, of course, because we're under strength, these things came around fairly frequently, because every troop was doing it. You couldn't say, well, you know, P troop is out today, A troop's going out tomorrow, and then Y troop will be out the night after. So you'll only be out one night and so on. You were bound to be on a patrol of some sort every day. That's the way it worked out. And besides that, you had, you know, the normal stand twos, the normal sentry duties in your own lines. So you could never say, well, I'll get my head down for about 4 or 5 hours during the day, having been out all night. You won't. You might be able to rest for 2 hours, but then you'd have to do a couple of hours on duty then again, and then it would be 2 hours off, 2 hours on, and then ready for another patrol. So it was a bit, hard in that way. And somewhere around about that time, I think they instituted a rest camp scheme. And around about that time, I was promoted. I was promoted to a corporal, taken behind a little bush and told that I would be a corporal. And when I said I didn't want to be a corporal and I didn't want any responsibility, I said, I don't want to do that. They said, well, you're already doing it. So I said, well, if you think I'm going to stick two stripes on my arm I said, for everybody to see us. And I said, I don't like the idea at all. So Captain Stevens said...
Why didn't you like the idea of the two stripes anyway?
Well, I didn't want any identification that I was a leader of any sort. Because the binoculars, map cases, arm waving, always attracted snipers. And if they knock off the fellow who's giving the orders, there's chaos amongst the other people then, isn't there? And reluctance to go forward. So that was all out. That was the way we looked at it. So if we were doing it, they would be certainly doing it, wouldn't they? So I didn't relish the idea. So he said, well, you don't have to wear the stripes. And you're doing the job anyway now. He said, otherwise I wouldn't be telling you. So you might as well get the pay for it. Well, now, that's, the pay was hardly an incentive to make anybody want promotion in those days. However, I said, well, I'll carry on the way I was. And that's all that happened. I did just carry on. And it was just one of those things, you see, in a commando, I think it always went that way, that the man who was doing the job, or he automatically just took it over. As the we lost the NCOs. I mean, where we had about 7 or 8 senior NCOs in a troop, we only had 2. Sergeant Hazelhurst and a fellow named Stockell.
The others were casualties.
Yeah, you don't know where they became casualties. I don't. Somebody probably does, because they were with them. But the sergeants in charge of my section, who'd been training with me up to D-Day and saying that we'd be the best section in the troop, never even got off the beach. He sprained his ankle and got back on the craft again and came back to England. You do get the odd ones who are not fitted for the job, but unfortunately he was already a sergeant, you see, and he was fit. But only fit physically. Mentally, he wasn't. He was no good. So, of course, that meant that, I'd been in charge virtually from the beginning without knowing it. And because I had the Bren gun and we'd lost the 2-inch mortar, we'd lost the Pierce on the beach, and I'd lost my number 2, virtually troop headquarters had ceased to exist. And when I was just put with somebody else then, in another section, because I realised that I'd been in the commando longer than them, when I thought about it, and when Captain Stevens said to me, he said, well, yeah, you've been in the commando longer, and he said, you're doing the job, so get paid for it. However, that was the situation, so... As the leader of my party of half a dozen men or so, I had to tell Captain Stevens which chap looked the worst for wear, and he would say to him, "Right, well, send him down to him when he let me know." So when he told me send him down, I sent this chap down. And I eventually found out that they were going to this rest camp for a few days. And when they went there, they were deloused. They had showers. They had good food, hot food, and everything else. And they were looked after. Change of clothes, new underpants, new vests, and all that sort of stuff. And generally, for about 3 days, got away from everything. But that's all they were away for, and then they were sent back. And this went on. It didn't go on every day or every 3 days. I don't know what the interval was or how many each troop was allocated. So they didn't always come from my section. However, one day a chap returned, and he didn't belong to our troop, but he came to our troop just to find me, and he asked me if... It was what my name was, and did I have a brother? And it was then that I found out that my younger brother was down in the rest camp. And as we were Marines, he was on landing craft, and he was running the engines of the landing craft in his case, and they'd run troops ashore, and I'd been getting off. And then I later found out that my eldest brother had been on board one of the battleships that was shelling the beaches prior to our landing. So that there was three of our family there actually present on D-Day. But Eddie, that's my younger brother, his craft was hit by some underwater obstacle, actually, you know, on one of its runs. And it was sinking. And what I didn't know was that he'd been missing for a week. And it's just that the craft, they're trying to pump it out, and it used to be hand-pumped. A funny little wooden-handled hand pump on the side. And it drifted round the River Orne. And actually, they were behind the enemy lines without knowing it. And they beached it, and they repaired it. They put the only way I could term it is a puncture outfit that they used to have for bicycles. Well, instead of patches made of rubber, these were copper plates and copper nails. And they nailed it up and they pumped it out dry and then made it serviceable and brought it back again. So they did very well, and there was a lot of initiative, in getting the craft back into service again. And they were recommended for that. But he was down there, and he asked if this chap would pass me a message, and if I could get down there to see him. So of course I tried to do that, and I went to see Captain Stevens, but he said no. He said I can't. He said I can't afford to let any NCOs go. He said no, I must. Refuse. He said, I'm very sorry, he said. And I think he was genuinely was aggrieved about not being able to send me. But I didn't go anyway. And it made me so annoyed, though, because I just said, well, I'll go down with the truck. I'll go down with the Jeep, rather. They only went down in a Jeep. I said, I'll go down with the Jeep and come back with the Jeep. And the Jeep come to her. But he wouldn't. He said, no, no, no. It was better, he said, if you stay away from your family. He said, now that you've been away from them, he said, it is better. He said, if you don't resume any ties, he said, again. He said, bad enough the way it is. So I didn't see him, which is a bit unfortunate. But David, that was one of the penalties I had to pay. Just for assuming the command of this little bunch of men that I had. But the stay at Salinelles was, apart from the odd times when we went aggressively to create trouble for the Germans, and in doing so we lost a couple of men. They weren't always dead, but they became casualties, and of course we lost them that way. And there was always the feeling there that you can't win them all, and the more of these things we do, the more of the old troop will disappear, and your turn will come eventually. However, it didn't for me, and it wasn't that bad. Whether there's something in you that providing you can get a few hours of comparative peace and quiet where there's no anxiety of looking after other people became the thing with me more than looking after myself. And I was troubled, and I troubled later on with the same sort of feeling that I think Captain Stevens must felt the same way, that it's a very hard thing to tell men, to ask a man to go over there and do this and do that, knowing that he's likely to be killed. And really, you're sending him to his death. But by and large, the stay in Salinelles wasn't too bad. I think the only the main highlight of that was the weather changing, and I was out on one of these all-night patrols, and it absolutely poured down, and I was lying flat on the ground, and there was just nothing you could do. You had to just lie there, and the pouring rain, cold, miserable. And when it started getting light, I found I had a companion there. And a dead German, still in full regalia, tin hat, everything, been in a shallow grave, and the water had washed it all away. And I was lying across his chest, really, you know, this little bank on the, right on the edge. And I was lying there, looking into the night, you know, and of course, as it began to get light, and we were just about to, it'd be about the time when we had to withdraw, you know. And as I say, it had been pouring rain all night, absolutely sodden. And the water had washed this away, and there's his muddy features and his tin hat and his chest, and I was lying on his chest. I'm like, oh, God, God. Of course, he was smelling a bit as well. That's what attracted me to it. The smell was getting stronger and stronger as the minutes went by. But I didn't have to endure that much longer. We left that and I came away. The only trouble was that when I got back, I found that my slit trench was flooded right up to the top. All my gear was on the bottom. And that was a little bit of an annoyance, because I couldn't even get it out until the rain subsided. And that the slit trench drained out again. So that was a bit of an annoyance there, because I had to stay in the soaking wet clothes that I had. Not that I had a battle dress down there to change into, but, you know, I could have... We did. And we were able to go a little bit further back from the slit trenches. And in the trees and that, you could wash and clean yourself, you know, you could strip off and clean yourself and, you know, get dressed straight away again, you know, as long as you did it quickly. So you could keep yourself reasonably clean, and we did. But, of course, in this case, I couldn't do nothing about it because all my clothes were in the bottom. And then we were taken out of the line there, and we were moved to a place well, it had been a place, and I think it was called Dzuli. I don't know how you spell it. Some D-O-U, double L-E at the end. Dzuli. And the guards had fought there. And on the road, there was a couple of their tanks knocked out, you know. And we knew it was the guards, because there was battle dress blouses lying on the road as well. With the, of course, they had the guards, you know, I can't remember which regiment, but the guards' badge on their shoulders. I don't know why, or they were just thrown around. But that was like a salient in that place. And it had been fought for by the both sides. And it looked as though it had been bombed almost out of existence. There was rumours that, in actual fact, early on in the landings, the German tanks had been concentrated there, or they'd assumed that tanks were concentrated there. And they bombed this town. And they bombed this with, you know, one of these massive raids they had. And it was, you could see with the naked eye, you could see the village. And this road ran through a woods, and it must have been a beautiful place in its time, you know, before it was, the destruction fell out. But this road ran right through, nice, neat, straight road, and all the trees lying near the edge of it. And it used to strike me as being a great pity that, you know, you couldn't... walk in the woods without getting shot, you know, shot at, and that it was so dangerous to be there in this little patch of ground. And you could see where the town had been on the right, and the railway lines were actually standing upright like that, you know, and there was actually a railway engine standing like that. How the heck it stood upright on its tender? The engine stuck right up in the air. Must have been an enormous amount of bombs dropped on it. Wiped it out completely. And that part of the woods, it reminded me of the pictures you see of the Great War, where the stumps of trees are sticking up, you know, and they're devoid of branches and leaves. And it was a total destruction there. And that was a rather queer place, because that again was nothing but patrols. And in actual fact, I think some of the men arrived at the breaking point there. And I don't think I did myself any good by, although I don't think I was alone in doing it, that some of the men actually were on the breaking point. And they, I think they were ready to refuse without they got some rest. And I had to see Captain Stevens about it. And I mentioned it to Captain Stevens and said, you know, words to the effect that, my men were, in a pretty poor state. And that, the patrolling was coming around a bit too regularly, and they were getting no rest. His reply was, well, look, we have got to make this look as though it's held by battalions. And you just couldn't do it, you know. We only had about 30 men. And it meant that you had to be out all the time, and there was some sort of activity had to be going on all the time. And you had to deny the Germans, the Germans at this particular point were not sitting back and taking it. They were quite prepared to come out and patrol as well, you know. And they were quite prepared to hit at any place where they thought you might have a patrol. There was many times when we were lying there, but because you're lying there so spread out, the effect was not wasn't too bad on you, you know, casualty wise. I mean, and they'd fire these small grenades at you in your direction. You had an idea that they couldn't see you, but in actual fact, from some of the positions that we had, we could see the Germans using their latrines, walking quite openly to their field latrines, and sitting down and using them. And we were told not to shoot at them, not because we might have thought that was unethical in any way to shoot him while he was at his ablutions, but the object was to give them the knowledge that we were that close to where they were and that we could see them, and it was more valuable to us to be able to see their daily life sort of thing, rather than for them to go and hide again, or drive them into hiding. I think that was behind it more than any retaliatory message that they might do against us. So it was a bit of a hair-raising place to be. And besides that, you were the shells were going in all directions. Over you as well, apart from landing on you at odd times, or landing in your area. And just to give you an example of the casualty rate, we had an influx of reinforcements came, and most of these men were time serving. Although they weren't old men, you know, when I said they must have been about 24, 25 maybe. They were older than me, and they had been in the Royal Marines, and they'd been on board ships. And at that time, I think we were combing everywhere to get people to reinforce the the troops who were actually fighting, because it was an infantry battle at the time, and it were, you know, the casualties were, you know, outnumbering the reinforcements, I think. Anyway, we got these fellows, and they were a bit on the haughty side to me, you know, and they gave me the impression that